Accession number 23329, reel 11.
Cal Younger, reel 11.
Don't think I even need to say that reminds me. two members of my barrack, Jack Catley and D.V. Smith, we always called him D.V., thought up another tunnel plan. They began in one of the latrines. The entrance was actually hidden under a boiler, and it was dug deep to avoid the seismographs, which alerted the Germans to any digging that was going on. It had the usual amenities of electric lighting and air pumps, and it was propped with the traditional, or in the traditional method, which was that we all parted with one or two bedboards, which were just the right length for both the uprights and the roof of the tunnels. The Germans did suspect that there was a tunnel somewhere, and they made great efforts to find it without success. Then the commandant even asked Dixie Deans if he knew of any schemes afoot, and Dixie, who had inspected the tunnel only half an hour earlier, was hard put to find an answer to that. But he did. He said that he knew of nothing that he felt should not be there. The next thing was that the Abwehr brought in a steamroller, which they drove around the perimeter of the camp between the warning wire and the main fence, hoping to cave in any tunnels that were there. However, the roof of the tunnel held. But it did make the tunnelers feel that they didn't have much time, that sooner or later the tunnel would be discovered, and so they decided to break it prematurely, really. It was still short of the wood where they had hoped to make the exit. There were about 50 men involved in the attempt. It could have been another great escape. We all knew something was going on. The atmosphere in the camp was very tense. And eventually we heard a shot, and then a second shot, and we didn't know what had happened, but we were pretty apprehensive. In fact, seven men had got out of the tunnel safely, but the eighth had been seen by a patrolling sentry. Queue in the tunnel was routed out by the Germans, and they were crammed into the cooler. Later, most of them had to be released, and then they served their sentence in turn, because there wasn't room for them all in the cooler. But the Germans thought they'd caught the first man out. They didn't realize that seven had gone. And nevertheless, the counters came around. It was, of course, at night, and they somehow our people managed to convey to their friends as they were led away that seven had got loose. And so when the counters came around, the number of dummies they found in beds tallied with the number of prisoners they had taken. But in various barracks, the seven dummies had been removed, and their places taken by men who went through trapdoors that had been cut from one barrack into the next, so that somebody counted in one room could be counted again next door. One of the escapers was recaptured, and so immediately another roll call was held, and once more the grapevine had functioned, and only six men were covered up. Well, that was all right. The Germans reckoned they'd made a mistake of one the day before, and all was well. But unfortunately, the same thing happened the next day, and it happened again on the third day. So the Germans were now getting really very worried. So the security people, the ferrets, brought in boxes with all our identity cards. Each box for the brick barracks, nine barracks, had 450 cards. When they started at A1, the first room, they planned to identify the men in that room and then move on to the next and then the next up the whole row that constituted A block. Unfortunately for them, they left the box unguarded for a moment, and into the fire went their box of cards. And there were cards filched in some of the other barracks as well. So the Germans then resorted to what we call the sheep count. We were massed on the parade ground, and we had to pass in single file between two lines of counters, and then we assembled again outside the ring of guards, away from the men who'd not yet run the gauntlet. Well, the count took quite a long time. The trouble was the counters didn't score the same. We tended to help them. When they said one number, we said the next, and they said the next. So they ended up with around 45 too many. So we had to go through it all again. At this time, just two officers counted, and they held hands and encircled each prisoner with their arms, just like the old game of oranges and lemons that children used to play. Remember, last man's head off. When a man had been counted, he went quietly into a hut, and or one man who had been counted went quietly into a hut, and he opened a window overlooking the parade ground, and to distract the attention of the sentries, people were inserting lighted cigarettes into the barrels of their rifles, which they carried over their shoulders. They laughed, they were quite amused, most of them, and they didn't see prisoners who hadn't been counted climbing through the window into the hut and disappearing out the other side. So the counting went on into the night, and searchlights illuminating the parade ground, and there were New Zealanders dancing Maori hakas around a fire. And towards midnight, after 8 hours, the Germans finally gave up. For several weeks, even after all the escapers had been rounded up and the numbers made correct, the sheep count was persisted with. We knew that it could have been made foolproof, and that sooner or later the Germans would learn our tricks, but eventually they reverted to the old system. The Germans then tried to reconstitute the files. Now, they didn't send for the duplicates which were held in Berlin. Possibly the commandant was apprehensive about asking for them, or maybe Berlin didn't wish to lose a second lot. So we were marched into the Vorlager and then drafted back one at a time through the gate into the compound, and those for whom there was no card were shepherded to clerks who filled in new cards, and then to the photographer and the fingerprint man, and at the end of it the Germans should have had every man accurately tabbed. Unfortunately for them, they had 500 composite cards, for almost every man was recorded under one name, fingerprinted under a second, and photographed as somebody else. As many had switched identities at Stalagate B a couple of years before that, and were actually army privates masquerading as RAF aircrew, the whole business was getting extremely complicated. Eventually, the Germans had to ask for the records from Berlin, and a group of Gestapo came along with them. So it was not long before the Germans had everything under control again. Yes, the Germans had destroyed the tunnel, of course, but it had left a ditch running from the latrines to the fence. And they realised that the use of the steamroller had forced us into prematurely breaking the tunnel, so they kept running the steamroller around the camp perimeter, but invariably the steamroller got stuck in the ditch. They usually got it out by creating a sort of ramp with balks of timber, and on one occasion, probably the final occasion if I remember rightly, when they had got the great machine out of the ditch, they took a bit of a rest, and prisoners managed to run off with the balks of timber going in all directions. Godfrey Loder had grabbed one of the pieces of timber and was chased by a guard who was overtaking him. So Loder swung around and dropped the plank so that it went neatly between the legs of his pursuer, and the guard fell. He was winded, and Godfrey escaped. The sentries in their boxes could see what was happening, and they rang for the dog handlers, who arrived and let the dogs loose, and they followed with tommy guns themselves. Well, there was panic then, and men were going through open windows, three or four at a time, and only one dog succeeded in entering a barrack, and it almost caught one of the chaps, but somebody else threw a boot, which caught it on the snout, and that ended. That ended what Toby described as comic relief.
I mentioned the tunnel earlier, the one from which eight people escaped, or rather seven escaped, the eighth was caught. It was months before they all served the three-week bread and water solitary confinement to which they'd been sentenced. There just wasn't room in the cooler for all of them. Now, in that tunnel, bedboards had been used as props. Every man had contributed two or maybe three bedboards. I don't know if I've previously described the wooden bunks. We had two-decker bunks, and the bedboards lay across about 11 or 12 of them, so that you had a complete platform, if you like, to lie on. You could manage without two or three. However, to prevent further sabotage, as the Germans put it, we had six bedboards confiscated by the Germans, and there was a lorry came around the camp, and it went from one barrack to another, and followed by prisoners who kept stealing boards back, sometimes upsetting the man who was standing on top of them, the German guard. And finally, the lorry reached the parade ground, having done its complete circuit, and the prisoners kept pinching back the boards. And the guard was there, but he wasn't armed. If he'd had a machine gun, he'd probably have used it. But he picked up a bedboard and tried to slam the fingers that were reaching from all directions. He managed to hit some, but there were plenty more. He dragged the boards from the bottom of the pile. His balance grew more precarious by the second. But then an officer appeared, flourishing a pistol, and the prisoners fell back, and he ordered everyone to withdraw to a distance of 200 metres, which would have taken everybody right out of the camp. Then a little German with a Tommy gun politely asked to be excused and made his way through the crowd, and he it got up onto the lorry, which had become bogged. The parade ground was really a sea of mud. Anyway, he got up to assist his friend and colleague. We knew he was a clerk in the commandant's office, and everybody was quite unafraid of him. He stood very self-consciously, and soon the whole gathering of Kriegies was singing, "Why was he born so beautiful?" Then there was applause, and people shouted, "Speech, speech," and he raised his Tommy gun once, but he was really blushing and was very embarrassed. Anyway, the lorry finally was extricated and the prisoners drifted away. The steamroller made one more appearance. It desecrated a small strip of watered and sun-baked sand, sacred to 9/10 of the prisoners. It was the cricket pitch. And the driver went across right in the middle of an over. England was playing Australia in the first of a series of three test matches. And there was the same kind of excitement that has characterized every England versus Australia test ever played. The parade ground, which also did service as a sports area, was long rectangular in shape, and local rules had to be devised. The pitch was placed near the barracks, and from one end, the bowler's run-up was between two huts. There was a full boundary circuit, except for the segment behind the wicket at what we called the barracks end. Now, the batsman at that end automatically was credited with one run when the ball hit either of the two wooden huts which were adjacent to the wicket. And from the other end, two runs were scored from a drive to the huts. The Australian captain was Johnny Shielaw, who was later to lose his life when typhoons shot up the people on the march. But come to that later. Shielaw scored a century. He was a beautiful batsman to watch. He played for Adelaide University, and he had the potential to go a long way, but alas, his life was cut short. England had a pretty good fast bowler named Harris. He'd played, I think it was for Surrey seconds, despite a leg injury which had left him with a permanent limp, and it was pretty painful, he bowled very cleverly and very well. The Australian side included a veteran named Jack Connolly, who'd played both cricket and baseball for Sydney University and had had a trial with the New South Wales Sheffield Shield side. Now, I'm sure that the story of that cricket match will have been told in cricket pavilions all over the Dominions. The players had made real effort. They wore white shirts. I don't know where they got them. And white shoes, sand shoes, and they'd slept on their uniform trousers, and they walked on to the field in that almost reluctant way of cricketers, and took up their places. It seemed to bring a redolence of home, really. The atmosphere was terrific, and the play was very good too. Now, what happened was that England needed 10 runs for victory, and they had one good batsman and Harris, the bowler, who was a dud. And the object of the Aussies, obviously, was to get Harris in front of the bowling. They reckoned if they could do that, the match was all but won. But the other English batsman, McGlashan, who later became a distinguished civil servant, managed to keep taking a single off the last ball of each over. At the barracks end, he would simply turn the ball against one of the walls of the two huts. He didn't have to run. The run was entered in the scorebook and the batsman changed ends. Now, the margin between the two teams dwindled to 4 runs. Now, Connolly ran up to deliver the first ball of what was likely to be the last over. And he was determined to get Harris up to the batting end. So he bowled a ball that was fairly wide, not wide enough to be called, and it was turning away from the batsman, and he thought that Connolly was trying to trap him into hitting it against the wall so that he would willy-nilly score a single. So he let it go. But there was a lot of turn on that ball, and it bounced against the wall. And it was only then that people realised that the wily old Connolly had turned the local rule to his own advantage. He'd bowled a bye. And that compelled the batsman to change ends. The end came quickly. There was a bellow of disapproval from the English supporters. Dirty old Connolly, hang him on the wire, they called. And the game ended with a diving catch by a Queenslander named Lex Smith. There was controversy for days after the match, and I've still heard arguments about it 50 years later. Partisanship around the sports field was intense. Whether a game was between huts or national teams, and there was a brave man who agreed to referee a match. It reflected in microcosm, I suppose, sports action worldwide. There was a boxing match between an English boxer named John Tracy, who was our champion, and the American whose name we never knew, but he was just called the Bearded Marvel. The Americans were by now in a separate compound, so the match was staged in our compound but near the boundary wire, so that the Americans could see it as well. The Brits argued that beards were not permitted in boxing, and there were insults from a distance, between us as the bearded marvel prevailed.